If you'd like to open your Bibles with me in Matthew 27. If you'd like a Bible in your hand, there are Bibles in the racks at the back. If you'd like to follow the service, the Bible verses, just get up now and grab a Bible. If you just get comfort from craving a Bible anyway, just grab one. And they're there for you to use. We're not going to go beyond this chapter, these verses this evening. We're working our way through Matthew, we've come to Matthew 27 now, from verse 51. Jesus is on the cross, and he's just died, and it says, "At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. And when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, 'Surely he was the Son of God.' Many women were there, watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. And as evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. 'Sir,' they said, 'we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, "After 3 days I will rise again." So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Well, take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting a guard. Very dramatic, isn't it? I don't know if you've seen Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, but my favourite moment in the film is as Christ dies, there's a storm cloud, a rain cloud above Jesus, and the camera position sort of swivels around to be above Jesus in the cloud, and you see a raindrop sort of form, like a pearl, a raindrop forms, and it falls on Christ, and the rain falls as he dies. It's incredibly dramatic, beautiful piece of filmmaking, like a tear from heaven. Something cosmic is happening here. Just the way Mel Gibson shows that something universal, something massive is happening here. But history is littered with examples of people who didn't see the importance of what was happening. Something big happening, and people were there but didn't realize that something was happening that was changing the world and going to change their life forever. And as human beings, we're kind of resistant to change in our minds. I've often referred to it, and I continue to do so. One of my favourite books is a book called Descartes' Error by Antonio Damasio. He's a neuroscientist, and he examines how human beings make decisions, and he came to the conclusion that it's not based on logic. That was the error of the great thinker René Descartes, who said, "I think, therefore I am," and decided that human reason would be the arbiter of all decisions. And Antonio Damasio said, "We really don't make decisions on the basis of logic alone. And he cites examples of people who've lost the ability to function as human beings, but they're still perfectly logical. They just can't live in the world. They can't make sensible decisions. He says that most of the decisions we make are based on emotion and instinct and experience and feeling. And there's reason in there as well, but we don't make our decision purely on reason. We've got to feel that we want to make that decision. We've got to feel right about it as well. And if we don't feel right about it, even though it's logical, we might not take that decision. We might not have the courage to take that decision. And that's true of religion as well. Things can be pointed out to us, but because for whatever reason we're reluctant to go with that decision, well, we don't. And I've known many people who've been convinced that Jesus Christ died on the cross for their sins, believe that he rose from the dead, but they will not make that decision to commit their lives to Jesus Christ. They just don't feel quite up to making that decision, and they will take years delaying that decision, putting off the decision, going along with Christians, but never quite becoming one. And that's because that's the way humans are. It's not all logic. There's something in their heart that's stopping them. It isn't just Christians. It can be anything like that. So that there's, in this passage, there's something happening that's cosmic, something enormous, and people are kind of half getting it, but they're not prepared to make that step and say, yeah, we just crucified the Son of God. So we begin with verses 51 to 53. The earth is shaken out of its inactivity. It's a fantastic analogy, in fact, to the whole of Matthew's gospel. It says the earth shook and the rocks split at the moment Christ died. And if you've been following for this whole year that we've been working our way through Matthew's gospel, what you see is that there's tension, there's opposition right the way through the book. The Messiah is nearly murdered before he's a toddler. He escapes by the skin of his milk teeth before from Herod, before he can be killed. And the family has to run to Egypt. And the opposition doesn't stop there. There's spiritual opposition, there's political, religious opposition. And Jesus is opposed all the way through his ministry. Even his own disciples don't believe him. And now suddenly, it all comes to a head. And the two massive tectonic plates are in opposition. Just like spiritually, there's opposition between the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness, like two massive tectonic plates bumping into each other. And you know, where tectonic plates meet, you get volcanoes and eruptions. That's what's happening in Jesus' ministry. The kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of light are meeting and crashing into each other, just erupting in sparks, in tension, in miracles, in healing, in miraculous things, and also vicious opposition that ends in the crucifixion of the Messiah. And at that moment, the perfect visual, the perfect example of God just underlining something, the earth shakes under them. Some people need an earthquake in their lives to make them believe. That's the truth. Some people need to be shaken. Some people need a massive thump in their life to make them realize that they need Jesus. The consequence of the earthquake was that the temple, the curtain in the temple was torn in two. Not sure how that happened, but it did. And the rock split and some tombs opened. There was minor structural damage, the newscasters would say. Minor structural damage. But it was frightening. And it should have sent a message. I've only ever been in one earthquake in my life, and we had one in Bangor a few years ago. I don't know if you remember it. I was sitting in my living room at the time, late afternoon, and I thought, there's a bit of a rumble. I thought, oh, a heavy lorry's gone past. I thought nothing of it. Next day, I saw the headlines, earthquake in Bangor. It measured about 1.3 on the Richter scale. But, you know, by Bangor standards, that was big. But you think the earth is solid beneath your feet. You think it is, but it's not. The earth is not solid beneath your feet. And if you want to really feel what an earthquake is like, I don't know if they still do it in the Geology Museum in London, but you can go and they've got this metal platform you stand on, and the projection of the front, and the actual soundtrack of an earthquake happening. And you go there, and suddenly this platform shakes, and you get the sound of an earthquake happening, and you experience an earthquake in the bowels of the Geological Museum next to the Natural Science Museum in South Kensington. And you think the earth is firm beneath your feet, but it's not. And some people think they've got it all sus spiritually, but they haven't. They think they know everything, but they don't. They think nothing's going to shake them, and something can. And things were happening. People began to see prophets and preachers of the past appearing. And they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Does anyone notice that? Isn't that something strange? The holy city has just crucified the Son of God. And they call it the holy city. There doesn't seem to be much holy about Jerusalem at this precise moment. Whether Matthew's just been a bit ironic, I don't know. Or whether it's just what they were called. Maybe the fact it's holy, the fact that God had chosen it, and that's where the Messiah had chosen to live. But it does seem rather an unholy event to happen in the holy city. So, the earth is shaken out of its inactivity as Jesus dies, and it's God's kind of wake-up call, it's God's alarm clock to wake up and see what's happening. Then the oppressors are shaken out of their neutrality in verse 54. The centurion and those who were with him, were guarding Jesus, saw the earthquake and all that had happened. They were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." The centurions were just keeping order. It was a lousy job. As if things weren't bad enough with the Passover and overtime. The plenty of overtime, but all leave was cancelled. Everyone was on duty because tensions were high anyway. And in the middle of it all, you have a crucifixion. They didn't want to be there. They didn't know anything about Jesus, so very, very little about him. And they're watching Jesus. They watched Jesus die, and now they wished he hadn't. They've just realized they've taken part in a miscarriage of justice. I don't know, can you just try to imagine the modern media types organizing the resurrection? Can you imagine if the people who organized the Olympic Games organized the resurrection? You know, you'd have the military band, you'd have the flypast of the Red Aloes, you'd have the Queen dropping in from a helicopter, you'd have Jesse J and Paul McCartney singing, you'd have invited VIPs in a ticket, you'd have volunteers with uniforms and big hands pointing you to the tomb. But it's not the way God does it. God shook the whole earth and said, "Now will you listen to me?" And he shook the oppressors, he shook the soldiers out of their neutrality. And the secret disciples are shaken out of their obscurity. The secret disciples are shaken out of their obscurity. If we go to the next verse, verses 57 to 60. Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus. By Jewish law, by Roman law, what normally happened with the crucifixion was normally the Romans left the body nailed to the cross to rot as a wake-up call to everybody else, normally. But the Jews didn't like that. because to the Jews that was kind of unholy and they didn't like that done. So they usually tried to persuade the Romans to take the bodies down. So the Romans said, okay, well, the family members, if the family members pay, we'll give them permission to take the body off the cross and bury it properly. So if you had money, you could buy the body off the cross and give it a decent burial. And on this particular occasion, because the following day was the day, the big day of the Pentecost, of the Passover feast, the Jews really wanted that body off the cross. So the Romans were happy to give permission to a rich man called Joseph of Arimathea. He comes at twilight because in a sense he's a twilight disciple. He's rich. He's one of the rulers, it says. One of the 70 members of the Sanhedrin, the religious rulers of the nation. Luke calls him a good and righteous man. Matthew 27 says he'd become a disciple of Jesus. And, well, what can one say about that? He appears to be kind of a twilight disciple of Jesus. He's a disciple, but kind of not quite there. Anyway, he comes and he takes the body of Jesus. So he belongs to the ruling class that killed Jesus. He steps in and takes the body to give it a decent burial. We're also told in the other Gospels that, not mentioned in Matthew, but Nicodemus, who if Joseph Arimathea is a disciple of the night time of the twilight, then Nicodemus is a disciple of the night time because he came to Jesus at night, hidden under cover of darkness, to ask him about becoming a follower and finding the kingdom of God. We're told that Nicodemus brought a massive, about 30 kilos of spices to anoint the body with. So the secret disciples of Jesus are shaken out of obscurity. The oppressors are shaken out of neutrality. The secret disciples are shaken out of obscurity. And the authorities are shaken out of their complacency, verses 62 to 66. Nigel Wright, the theologian, says this. Greeks and Romans thought the body is corrupt and that a soul is liberated from the body. Resurrection was not only impossible, but it was undesirable. The Jewish people, on the other hand, believed in resurrection, but at some future point when God will renew the entire cosmos. It was a future event, not something that happens here and now. He says the idea of an individual being resurrected in the middle of history while the rest of the world continued on burdened by sickness, decay and death was inconceivable. The resurrection didn't really fit then with the Romans' view of life because they thought that you were better off dead, your soul was liberated. And the Jews, because they would only have resurrection at the end of the age. It wasn't on either of their agendas. But the authority knew that if they couldn't produce the body of Jesus, they could never finally silence him. So they're shaken out of their complacency and they put a guard on the tomb as if that is going to stop Jesus. It struck me as I was writing this that trying to stop Jesus is as impossible as trying to stop the tide. Do you remember as a child you used to play on the beach and you used to try and stop the tide? You'd build your sandcastle and you'd build a wall around it and you'd build a big wall around it and you'd say to the sea, there, now then, come on if you think you're hard enough, you know. And the first few waves were repulsed and you said, yeah, look at my castle, this is good, and those walls would stand. And then you'd watch as the sort of waves kind of went round the back and began cutting away at it, and it wouldn't be long, would it, before your impregnable castle was swamped by the incoming tide. And that's what the authorities are trying to do. They're trying to stop Jesus. So the authorities have always tried to do. The Romans tried to overcome Jesus, and 300 years later, the Roman Empire succumbs to Christianity. In my own time, we watched the communist authorities try and build their wall against the incoming tide of Christ. And they failed. And now you can travel Eastern Europe. I'm going to be listening to Tim later on talking about Ukraine, where they tried to build a barrier against Christ. You go to Russia, China, anywhere in the world where the communist authorities tried to shut Christ out, and they failed. You get swamped. You can't shut Christ out. A final comment from N.T. Wright. He said, Jewish revolutionaries whose leader had been executed by the authorities and who managed to escape arrest themselves had two options: give up the revolution or find another leader. Claiming that the original leader was alive again was simply not an option. Unless, of course, he was. So imagine reading this story now by candlelight. You're in the early church and you're reading it by candlelight in a semi-secret meeting. The early church didn't have its own buildings, often met sometimes in the catacombs under the ground. And you're reading about the earth shaking and the authorities' futile attempt to shut Jesus out. It's a revolution, isn't it? And if you're reading this in the early church, what a feeling that must have been to have this story read to you in the early church, semi-underground, as the authorities trembled, the whole earth trembled before Jesus. And the question comes back in as you were reading it in the early church, well, are you going to join the revolution? Are you going to become a follower of this Christ? Are you going to make that decision now, tonight, to follow him? What does it take to shake you out of your complacency? What does it take to shake you out of your doubt? What does it take to shake you out of your lethargy and your inertia? What does it take to make you follow the Christ? He's risen. And nothing you can do will change that. He's alive and he's risen. So, you're going to follow him. That must have been exactly how it felt in the early church. And you know, really and truly, it's the same today. The same question comes to us. The earth has shaken. Christ has risen. Will you follow him?